They are U.S. citizens by birth, but they do not feel they are part of the, quote, American project, and they're forever at the margins looking in. We're looking at race and national belonging this hour with Nilda Flores Gonzalez. She's a professor with a joint appointment in sociology and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She focuses on race and ethnicity, children and youth identity, Latino sociology and education. Her new book is Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. Nilda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to your show.
You talked with about 100 Latino millennials who are U.S. citizens and found that they generally don't feel like they're actually Americans, that they're actually fitting in. What's going on here?
Well, I think it's the messages that they receive in their everyday life. So there are two things. One is discourses that and narratives about Latinos that we have as a society that we hear through the media, that we hear politicians talking about that many times criminalize Latinos or make them look like undeserving or less than American. And then the other thing is their everyday life. There are manifestations of this same thing, is attitudes that they encounter from people, as well as behavior and discrimination that they face in their day-to-day life. And these messages convey to them that their membership in society is precarious, you know, that they are not counted as full members of society.
And you refer to this incidence as racial microaggressions. Can you explain these microaggressions?
Yeah, so racial microaggressions is a term that is used to describe large as well as small, or more blatant versus more subtle kinds of discrimination that happen on everyday life. And so this refers to some slights that may happen in interactions with people. It could be, some of the examples I have in the book are about young people in the train, sitting on the train and realizing that white people won't sit next to them, for instance, that they're avoided. Or walking into a store and not receiving service or being followed. Or, you know, so some of these are verbal things in which people may say racist things to them or may question them. But oftentimes these are very subtle things that happen in everyday life that people of color are familiar with.
Nilda, when you interviewed these millennials, these Latino millennials, did you have to draw this out of them, or were they readily able to talk? Because this is a really personal issue. Were they readily able to bring that out and talk about this candidly?
Yeah, the majority of them did talk about. And if I may, I'm just going to tell you how I got into doing this project. Yeah. One of the things that I did was during 2006, there were these very large immigrant marches that swept around the nation. And in Chicago, these marches were really large. The first march drew about 100,000 people. The second march in May drew about 600,000 people. And so we interviewed people who participated in the marches. And, you know, with my emphasis on youth, I started interviewing young people who had participated in the marches. And one of the things that came out, and that project for me was about political socialization. It was about how young people learn to be political and act politically. And what actually came of that, this concept that what I call the book, Citizens But Not Americans, a lot of the young people were talking, and these were U.S. citizens, were talking about this feeling of that despite their citizenship, they really didn't count as Americans. Now, in that project, I didn't ask the right questions to pursue these areas, so I went back and we did interviews with young people who had participated in marches and who had not, because we wanted to get at, you know, what is going on? Why are they saying this? Why do they have that feeling? Now, for me, this was familiar because I've been teaching at the University of Illinois at Chicago, which is has a very large Latino population. So I heard this from my students, too. And so as I went back to do these questions, we asked young people about what they thought was their race, their ethnicity, and their thoughts about citizenship and Americanness. And they were pretty candid. And, you know, as sociologists, we look for patterns. And what I found was in these interviews, in these almost 100 interviews, young people were saying pretty much the same story. It varied individually by personal characteristics, but pretty much these young people were pretty open about talking about their experiences.
There was this one young woman, and what she said to you just kept sticking with me through the book, that she said, her papers are straight. My papers are straight. There's nothing wrong with my papers. And yet, she said, I just don't feel like an American citizen. And it kept it dawned on me, like, because of all of the crackdown on immigration recently, the news around DACA, the Dreamers, I'm wondering if that is permeating into her psyche, into her skin, and that's why she keeps going back to this thing with her papers.
Yeah, she was not the only one that talked a lot about that. And, you know, I would say that they are two main discourses that we hear about Latinos, and they both put down Latinos and as undeserving people. One is this narrative about Latinos are immigrants, and so it doesn't matter if you're born in the U.S., it doesn't matter if you're third, fourth generation in this country. Because you look Latino or because you have a Latino surname, a Spanish surname, you're identified as Latino. And so therefore, your citizenship and your status in this country is dubious, is under suspicion. And so these young people encounter this all the time in their daily life, people assuming that they are immigrants when they in the case of the young people in my book, they're not. They are U.S. citizens, second and third generation. The other narrative that a lot of these young people encounter is that the one that criminalizes them as racial minorities. And this is very similar to the experience of Blacks, is criminalizing young people, particularly young men, as gang members and as criminals. And young women are also have encountered these sort of notions. So again, we see that these young people encounter this sort of dual narrative that criminalizes them either as undocumented or as criminals and people who want welfare and this kind of narrative that applies to other, to also applies to other groups besides Latinos.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nilda Flores Gonzalez. Her new book is Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. And Nilda is a professor in Latin American and Latino studies and in sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, talking about how Latino millennials feel they don't fit in as U.S. citizens, that they forever feel like they are on the margins, and discussing, you know, how big of an issue is this? Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. How do you see Latinos and Latinas fitting in your own community? Do you see them more as outsiders? Do you see them as your neighbor? 800-642-1234. Nilda, you write about the narratives in the book that reflect three themes. Latinos are an ethno race, Latinos as a racial middle, and Latinos as, quote, real Americans. Break down, first of all, ethno race. What is that?
Well, sociologically speaking, we tend to separate the concepts of race and ethnicity. And race is assumed to be those physical differences that people have. And so it's supposed to be based on phenotype and genetics and your biology, although we know that biology has nothing to do with these differences, that people are people regardless of how they look, that genetically there's nothing different, that the differences between being Black and white are the same as having straight hair or curly hair or having blue eyes or brown eyes, you know. So these are just these physical distinctions that do not have intrinsic changes in people's. And then when we talk about culture, ethnicity, we're talking about culture, about the cultural traits that people have. Now, as I said, we tend to, as scholars, make a distinction between race and ethnicity. And what I'm arguing in the book is that for Latinos, that doesn't really work. And really, when you think about it, when you think about racial groups and when you think about ethnic groups, they both have components of race and ethnicity within them. So, for instance, you think about Latinos, you think about there is a prototype about Latinos. There is a way in which Latinos are envisioned that they look like. So you can close your eyes and think Latino, and an image is going to come to your mind, you know. So that is sort of the kind of racial component of things that are visually that you can see and you can categorize people. On the other hand, they are cultural aspects. So the same way, if you think about Latino, you can think of cultural aspects that go with the term Latino, right? Speaking Spanish, you know, very family oriented, and so on. And so, what I'm arguing in the book, in that particular chapter, is that, you know, we need to kind of move away from these distinctions between race and ethnicity, because they really have, we should talk more about ethno-races, about groups that that we imagine as having both physical as well as cultural components. And so the argument on that, and what I found in my research is that these young people really had a hard time many times in distinguishing between race and ethnicity. They sometimes said their race is Latino, other times they say it is Mexican. Well, you know, according to the U.S. Census, that will be the wrong answer. Latino is not considered a race, it's considered an ethnicity, and that Latinos could be of any race. And so what I found is that these young people really did not see themselves as being white or as being black or as being any of the recognized races as the government defines them, but rather they saw themselves as a particular group that both had some of these assumptions of phenotype and physical characteristics as well as cultural characteristics.
You also describe this hierarchy in society where you have whites at the top, you have African Americans, blacks at the bottom, and Latinos coming in somewhere in the middle?
Yes. So when we look at sociological literature, we talk about racial hierarchies, about which groups have more privilege than others. And we know that in the U.S., we have a binary. The historical context of the U.S. has been one in which whites have had privilege, have been at the top. Blacks have been at the bottom. This comes from the legacy of slavery and the way in which this nation was constructed. And so this arrangement continues in these narratives about, and we see it not only in the narrative, but we see it tangibly in the life chances that people have. So Latinos are referred to as being a racial middle, a group that is somewhere between whites and blacks. And when I interview young people, and one of the assumptions also is that Latinos have been viewed as sort of equivalent to European groups that may not have been categorized as white at first, but then became white. And so a lot of the literature looks at and assumes that Latinos are an immigrant group that is on their way to becoming white. And so oftentimes Latinos are classified as a white ethnic group. When we fill out the census, for instance, there is no Latino category for race. And so many Latinos marked white, but they mark white. And in the interviews that I did, these young people talk about when they have these very constricted categories, they mark white. They may mark white because they're not black. It's sort of by default. It's like by I'm not this, so therefore I must be that. Others may mark black because they're not white, you know. So for them, these categories really don't have don't resonate with them. So they feel that they are in the middle, that in this racial hierarchy in this country, they occupy a space between blacks and whites, but it is a racial middle in which individual differences or individual traits that people have may locate them either closer to whites or closer to blacks. And so I refer to this as a racial middle that tilts toward white or tilts toward blacks. And so, for instance, those young people who tended to be lighter skin, or maybe were it was social class, they were middle class, or maybe they had a white parent, or maybe they lived in suburban communities that are predominantly white. Those young people tended, the few that said that they kind of tilted toward white were those who had sort of those characteristics. On the other end, youth who were darker skin, or that were from a lower socioeconomic status, or also that experienced more discrimination in their everyday life, tended to feel that they were closer to the Black experience and talked about being, you know, in the middle, but a middle that approximated that the status of Blacks. And so in that chapter, I tried to flesh out what this racial middle means. You know, we talk about Asians, we talk about Latinos occupying this racial middle. Well, what is that racial middle, and where does it sit? How do people feel that they, what is their location in the racial hierarchy in this country?
We're talking with Nilda Flores-Gonzalez. She's a professor with a joint appointment in sociology and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her new book is Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. If you're a Latino millennial and a U.S. citizen, do you see yourself as American or not really? In what ways do you feel marginalized or separate from society? How do you see Latinos and Latinas fitting in your community? Or do you see them as outsiders? Join in, 800-642-1234. Back in just a moment, perhaps hearing from you here on the Ideas Network. There's this certain societal hierarchy that we've been learning about with Nilda Flores-Gonzalez. She writes about it. Whites at the top of the hierarchy. She sees Blacks at the bottom, Latino, somewhere in the middle, sometimes skewing downward. Her new book, Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. She's a professor of sociology and Latin American studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, especially if you are a Latino millennial and a U.S. citizen. How do you feel about your place in American society? Join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris in Reeseville. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, good day. Great show, as usual. I just wanted to say I live in an agricultural community, and my neighbors actually work for the farmer that I worked for when I was younger, and we've become neighbors and found that connection, and I'm still serving in the service, and I have several people of color. I hate to use the word Latino or Mexican or because I don't like the classification because I think it separates us, and you know, I value their input into our community and our culture, and I personally value the mentorship I've received from those people. And I'm saddened by this survey saying that people don't feel American. And unfortunately, I think that it is a direct result of our multiculturalism education, because it separates us and doesn't focus on assimilation, celebrating the melting pot where, yes, everybody has their individual ethnicity or culture, but we are all American, and we need to celebrate that unity above the separation of quote unquote diversity.
Nilda, what about this melting pot, as Chris mentions?
Yeah, so when I ask some of the questions, also ask these young people sort of how do they deal with this, in what ways they see themselves as American. And I want to say that they do see themselves as American. They share the same values that Americans share. They believe in freedom, social mobility, opportunities that are open in this society. They also see themselves as being contributing members of society, of loving this country, of being patriotic. But they also are cognizant that despite the narrative in the U.S. as portraying itself as a nation of immigrants and a melting pot, that this is really kind of far from the truth. And, you know, sociologically speaking, when we talk about assimilation means that you leave your culture behind and take on another culture. Mm. So that would mean that you stop speaking Spanish, you stop eating ethnic foods, you stop behaving in cultural ways and celebrating your culture, but that you become completely American. And so what these kids feel, or these young people feel, is this push into Americanized, not only Americanized, but, you know, completely leave their culture behind. So that's what assimilation really does. And what they have in their everyday lives is messages from people that do not celebrate their culture, that do not allow them, even though we see ourselves as a nation of immigrants, as a melting pot, we don't like to see those differences. So many of the stories that they told were about, for instance, going into a store, and the moment that they speak Spanish, the interaction completely changes. They become invisible. They are disregarded. They're not provided service. So this was repeatedly, young people talked about how anytime their ethnicity came across, they were not seen as American. And so despite sharing the same values, despite, you know, they're born in this country, they're raised in this country, they're socialized, and they have taken on all these values, but yet their Latin American background, it strips them of their Americanness.
Chris, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Heather now in central Wisconsin, who has the counterpoint. Heather, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Well, building on what the previous caller said, I have experienced kind of like a reverse thing of what you say all of these young people are saying. And that when, you know, when I am in stores shopping, grocery or other stores, and you have these, you know, family or group of you know, Spanish-speaking people, they, you know, it's like they actually don't want to assimilate into the country and speak the, you know, the national language, which is English. They want to be separate. You know, and they want to emphasize their separateness and not their assimilation. So anyway, that can make, you know, the Americans, you know, uncomfortable, which it just kind of like proliferates the, you know, the feelings of separateness.
Nilda,
you know,
go
that
ahead.
They want to be separate. They want benefits, but they want their separateness.
Go ahead, Nilda.
I disagree with this. I think that for people who are older and migrate when they're adults, it's a lot more difficult to learn the language. Many immigrants oftentimes have lower levels of education. So for them, if they haven't had schooling in their countries, you know, it's very difficult to learn a language. Many of them are working two jobs to make ends meet. And so they don't have the flexibility to be able to go and take English classes. So if you ask any immigrant, of course they want to learn English. Of course they want to, you know, they recognize that is needed for them to be able to get ahead. So immigrants, you know, the parents, the grandparents, that's a different story because these are older people that are migrating and that is harder for them to switch into another language. The young people that I talk to, children, you know, young people who have grown up in this country, who have been born in this country, they're fluent in English. They are completely, you know, English is their main language because they have grown up here. So, you know, it is not that they don't want to. Sometimes people just can't. Imagine yourself moving to France and having to learn language now as an adult. How long is it going to take you to learn a new language? So it is not that they want to segregate themselves, But, you know, sometimes it's just difficult and they don't have the resources that would enable them to be able to learn a second language quickly. And also in the American spirit, you know, of freedom and of opportunity and of being tolerant and of being a nation of immigrants, we should be welcoming that. We should be okay with having people speak different languages. It is not that they're not necessarily functioning in English. I speak English. I speak Spanish. Spanish is my first language. I grew up in Puerto Rico, and when I'm out and I'm with people that speak Spanish, I speak Spanish. You know, that doesn't mean that I'm trying to segregate myself. That means that, you know, I feel comfortable and I think that I'm bilingual and I can express that. That's freedom. That is what is the essence of this country. And what these young people are saying is that they encounter in everyday life, you know, nasty looks, comments from people that are bothered by these kinds of issues. And, you know, it is not doing it against you or doing it against, you know, anybody. I think we should embrace this. This is what should be the American spirit.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the author Nilda Flores Gonzalez. Her new book, Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. She is a sociology professor and a dual appointment in Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're reaching her courtesy of WBEZ in Chicago. Nilda, you write about President Trump's campaign and how he called Mexican immigrants criminals. He called them rapists. He called for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, questioned the integrity of a federal judge because of his Mexican ancestry in the fraud case against Trump University. How would you describe the effect this has had on Latino millennials and how they view themselves?
I think that Trump's comments are part of a larger narrative. When we began the show, I talked a little bit about that, of this narrative that portrays Latinos as not belonging, as people who do not belong in this country. And so in that aspect, I'm referring at this narrative that presents Latinos as being permanent immigrants, you know, that despite being U.S.-born, despite being in the citizens of this country for many generations, you know, as in the case of the Southwest, Latinos continue to be seen as immigrants. And so you have these larger narratives that, and then the everyday life are smaller expressions of that narrative. You know, intolerance for hearing people speak Spanish is part of this larger narrative that constructs Latinos as being immigrants. On the other hand, there's that one narrative, the narrative of Latinos as immigrants, and that is applied to any Latino regardless of how many generations they have been in this country. If you look Latino, if you have a Spanish last name, if you speak Spanish, you know, those things immediately cast you as being an immigrant. On the other hand, we have the other narrative, and this has become, you know, again, using the example of Trump, because that's very visual, a larger narrative in this case about Puerto Ricans, which is the second largest Latino group in this country. And Puerto Ricans are a particular case because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens and have been U.S. citizens since 1917. Mm-hmm. So Puerto Ricans have been U.S. citizens before many European immigrants, you know, became, you know, that migrated to the U.S. after 1917 became immigrants. However, we know that about half of the population in the United States is not aware that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens and they have fought in every major war since World War I. But the narrative about Puerto Ricans that permeates at the national level is that is similar to the narrative about Blacks. Right, it's about welfare. It's about Puerto Rican wanting handouts. It's about Puerto Ricans not wanting to work, being lazy, having everything handed to them. And so, what we saw a week ago when Trump visited Puerto Rico after the devastation of Hurricane Maria was the disregard of Puerto Ricans and writing them off as being, you know, wanting handouts, as not wanting to pull themselves by the bootstrap, and so on. And so, again, these correspond to a narrative, a larger narrative that we have in society that disregards these groups as being, you know, less than desirable, as not being really embracing American values and being really American. And so, you know, again, in the rhetoric, in the narrative displayed by Trump, but also in his actions. And, you know, you can take the example that people are using about throwing the paper towels at people. That was very dehumanizing.
In Puerto Rico, when he visited, throwing paper towels and water and relief supplies at a crowd of onlookers. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. Instead of handing them, instead of, you know, and so his comments as well as his behavior show this larger narrative, expresses an it's a good example of the larger narrative that portrays Puerto Ricans as despite their, you know, so here we have, and in the case of Puerto Rico, I think it becomes very clear, because the case of Mexicans, you know, becomes murky because of the citizenship issue, you know, because of the immigration issue. But in the case of Puerto Ricans, you have clearly people who are U.S. citizens and who have been U.S. citizens since 1917, but yet are not treated as Americans.
And
the response of the government, the slow response to the Puerto Rican crisis, the insistence that Puerto Rico has to pay this debt and so on, sort of is very different from the response to Houston and in Florida after the hurricanes.
Let's go to Joe now in Milwaukee, who has a comment. Joe, go ahead.
I'd like to point out that it's going to be really impossible to integrate this many people because the vast bulk of Hispanics' growth has come from immigration the last few decades. And you've got such huge numbers where with any kind of group, you have to integrate them this way because they keep coming in from the same cultures. Secondly, racial differences are real. If you believe in evolution, you have to accept this because different selective pressures around the world is going to select for different behavioral traits. And that's something just something based on evolution. And that's why you see differences in sprinting ability and why those of West African descent always win sprinting competitions. Those of East African descent always win long-distance competitions. That's why especially Jews of Europe have such high IQs due to their evolutionary history and it's due to evolutionary pressures within their history. And finally, Puerto Rico doesn't pay any federal taxes and yet receives billions each year from the United States government, which is paid for by U.S. citizens in the 50 states.
And Joe, let's get Nilda to respond to one of your points. Go ahead, Nilda.
Well, the first point I wanted to respond to is about the sort of biological basis for behavior. And, you know, we really don't find that in research. You know, research shows that there's one race, which is the human race, human beings, and that they are differences, yes, there are cultural differences that are based on where you live, but that doesn't inherently make people more intelligent or less intelligent, more criminal or less criminal. Every group has all kinds of people. So there is really no biological or genetic basis for these claims. However, I recognize that this is part of a larger narrative that permeates in the U.S. that has been used to justify the sterilization of people, particular policies toward groups, the enslavement of people, you know. So this is part of a narrative that permeates, but that is really not based on science and is not based on factual evidence, that differences between groups are just that, are differences, and that in all groups you have all kinds of people that show these differences. So that is one of the things that I wanted to point out. The other thing about Puerto Rico is that Puerto Rico actually is one of the main markets of the U.S. So, yeah, Puerto Ricans in the island do not pay federal taxes and they receive federal aid, but Puerto Ricans actually are subsidizing and are spending billions and billions of dollars that come back to the U.S. And so one of the big issues that have happened with this hurricane is what the Jones Act means. And the Jones Act made Puerto Rican citizens, but it also stipulated that foreign ships can only come to one U.S. port, which means that all merchandise that goes to the island has to come in U.S. ships from U.S. ports with a U.S. crew, which means that in Puerto Rico, people pay incredible amount of money for merchandise because they have to pay these. You know, they have to pay the transportation cost that is monopolized by U.S. corporations. You have also that places like Walgreens and Walmart, they make the most profit from the Puerto Rican market. Regionally, Puerto Rico makes a lot of money for Walgreens, for Walmart, and for other companies. And so, yes, there is that relationship of not, you know, of the clause of no taxation without representation. So therefore, because Puerto Ricans cannot vote in presidential elections and do not have congressional members, they do not pay taxes. That is, you know, that is why this happens. But on the other hand, Puerto Rico is a mine gold for the U.S. and for corporations who are making lots of money that come then to the mainland. That money is not invested in the island. That money comes to the U.S. and benefits people like the audience, right?
And
this is money that comes back.
We're going to pause right there. We're talking with Nilda Flores Gonzalez. She interviewed about 100 Latino millennials, and she says they echoed the same sentiment again and again that they didn't feel truly a part of their own country, the U.S. She traces the roots of their feelings in her new book, Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. She's a professor with a joint appointment in sociology and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see the disenfranchisement of Latino millennials in your own community, in your workplace, at your church? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back after this quick break on the Ideas Network. When you look at the sheer numbers, Latino millennials will inevitably play a major role in our society here in the U.S. But for right now, they feel a disconnect. They are U.S. citizens by birth, but they do not feel they are part of the, quote, American project. Those were takeaways from Nilda Flores Gonzalez in her new book, Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. She's a sociologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where she also teaches Latin American studies. You can join into this discussion, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Victoria now in Madison. Go ahead, Victoria.
Hi, I just had a comment sort of in response to one of the earlier callers about the importance of, you know, in order for Latinos to feel like they belong in America, that they need to assimilate or abandon their culture. And for me, my I'm biracial, so my father is from Guatemala, and my grandmother, or my abuelita, and my father have since passed away. And so for me, like, I wish I could speak Spanish. I wish I had, you know, a Latino community with which to connect. And just, you know, I can still be an American, you know, and embrace American culture. But, you know, to abandon my Latino culture is to abandon half of the person that I am. So I had that response. And then also just, you know, in Wisconsin, you know, bratwursts are one of the biggest, you know, picnic food items. And that certainly wasn't invented in America. That's a German cultural heritage. And people can continue to keep their cultural heritage and their food and language and celebrate those things and be American citizens. So I don't understand that comment from the earlier caller.
Nilda, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of the things that I want people to realize also is my earlier comment about that for immigrants, it is difficult to learn a language, right? But their children speak English, and actually English is their first language. It's the language that they speak, that they can write, that they can read. Most millennials, Latino millennials that are second and third generation have, you know, basic understanding of Spanish. Oftentimes is colloquial Spanish, is being able to speak to their parents, but not necessarily functioning. So, you know, you have to remember that if you think of European immigrants, they went through that process, right? The first generation did not speak English. It is their children and grandchildren who become, you know, if you want to use the term, assimilated, and learn English and be dominant in that language. So, you know, as you are tolerant and think about your own, if you're white and you're thinking about your own family history, you need to allow that. You need to accept that other groups, you know, the first generation is not going to speak English necessarily because they come as adults. It is later generations that fully become integrated.
Victoria, thanks for calling in with your comments. Let's go to Carolina in Madison. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Carolina, and I want to thank the professor for being on and for talking about these issues that are so important, and people are just really misinformed out there. I mean, I think there are a lot of good people out there, but they're just really misinformed about what's what. I wanted to say that my family is from Venezuela, and I was born here and raised here. My mother spoke four languages, my father spoke four languages, we're all fluent, et cetera, et cetera. And something funny to tell the professor, I'm very white, I'm not dark, so my favorite thing to do is to break stereotypes. So I'll go to a store, wherever, I start speaking English, and then I'll switch to Spanish with my mom. And people are like, oh my God, where are you from? And nobody ever thinks Latin America, right, because we're white. And we're like, Venezuela? And so my favorite thing to do is just to break stereotypes and tell people, hey, we're all different colors. We can be white. We can be dark. And we're just like you. We just want the best for our families, the best for the country. We're just like anybody else. And please stop referring to race as something different than we're all the same people. Race, we're all human. There is no other race but human, and I wish people would get that. And thank you so much for listening to me.
Nilda, go ahead. Carolina.
Yeah, thank you, Carolina, for sharing your story. And your story, you know, it is very similar. It actually resonates with me because if you see me on the street, you would think I'm white. And I'm very light skin. And I also face the same thing. And typically because of the way I look, people don't guess Latin America. They typically think that I'm European or something like that. So that is something that many Latinos who are lighter skin contend with. But again, it's I think it's an issue of tolerance, of thinking again, of going back to what this nation says it is, that it's a nation of immigrants. And if we are a nation of immigrants, then we should be tolerant about differences.
Do you sense, Nilda, in the people you talked with, the Latino millennials, do you think that their views about themselves will change over time as they enter their middle years, in middle age?
We always evolve, you know. So I do work on identity, and I'm aware that people change their identities, that this is not something that is fixed, that their experiences shape things. And however, I think that and when I talk to people who are not millennials, for instance, about these issues, they share similar stories. So I think part of the, you know, so for you to be fully integrated, you know, people that like to use this assimilationist perspective of like, why don't they assimilate? Why don't they become American? Why don't they don't speak English? It's exactly because of those attitudes. It's exactly because you are being rejected. So the path to assimilation is one of acceptance, is one in which your group is afforded the same benefits as the other groups, the same privileges. And when your group is not, then, you know, you are not seen as part of the larger, you know, of the larger society. And so, again, you know, we need to look at sort of the attitudes and the actions that we see in people, the discrimination that continues to happen that tell Latinos that they do not belong or that they are less than. And so these young people, you know, I don't think this is something that is going to change. And one of the things that I think a lot about is that although we had all these policies in the 60s and 70s to change things, you know, the Civil Rights Act, yeah. I think that we have failed in changing, you know, we may have changed behavior and people may be scared of going to prison or of being fined or being sued. And so therefore they comply behaviorally many times, but that didn't change their hearts. And I think that the recent demonstrations in Charlottesville, you know, the rhetoric in Trump's, you know, when he talks in, you know, in all of these are manifestations of that these changes, that there's a core of group in the United States that have not changed their minds and that have not changed their hearts and that are not embracing diversity and are not embracing other groups that are different from themselves.
Let's fit in Lois here in Waukesha. Go ahead, Lois.
Yes, good morning. I have to say that I'm a person of embellished heritage, and I believe that we should begin legislation to ban the requirement to state race on registration paperwork at doctors, dentists, government, this sort of thing. Other countries don't have that. Why should we have to state our race? We are all one. We're all human beings, period.
Nilda, what steps can be taken in the future to help people come together, to help Americans come together?
So I wanted to address this issue about race because the U.S. Census is undergoing changes, and most likely there's going to be the way that race is going to be race and origin. And Latino will be a category. Now, you know, I know that we want to have a colorblind society in which we believe, you know, we have the ideal that race doesn't matter, that everybody's equal, but the reality is that race matters. And we see this when you do studies and you find the consequences in education, in the labor force, you know, all these different dimensions in which we can measure that Blacks, Latinos, you know, that some groups do more poorly than others. You know, those are tangible examples of why race matters. When you have that on the average, a group is doing disproportionately worse than others, is because they are being discriminated against. And so, again, you know, we need to measure race, maybe not use the term race, maybe social origin, maybe social groups, maybe social categories. But we do have these social categories. You know, when you think of Latino, you have something in mind and you have certain ideas about what Latinos are. So if we don't measure that, if we don't measure, we cannot tell which groups, how groups are doing in comparison to each other. So getting away from measuring race or measuring social categories actually does harm, because that will be regressing to a time in which you're not paying attention to, you know, we have done away with sort of affirmative action, but we really need to measure, because that's the way that we know the discrimination that groups are suffering, and then we can remedy that.
Lois, thanks for your call. And Nilda, as we begin to wrap up, what are some things we can do in our own personal lives to make more welcoming spaces in the places that we tread in life?
Yeah, I think that what we as sociologists try to instill in people is that we need to be conscious of our actions, and we need to be intentional, and that we all have prejudices. We grow up in this country. We are part of these larger narratives. We're part of societal institutions that have these particular narratives. And so we really need to recognize and look at our behavior. And one of the things that we have found, and one of my colleagues has done work on, you know, sort of people who have the best intentions but end up discriminating. And what we find is that even people who do not see themselves as racist and who do not want to, you know, who believe in equality, many times end up doing discriminatory actions or because they're not conscious of their own behavior. And so
going back, you know, to the microaggressions.
Exactly. You know, that these are things that people may not realize they're doing. And so I think we need to pay more attention about, you know, sort of what is behind that. And, you know, I think that the last caller, you know, caller is talking about, you know, we should all accept each other. We should all be, you know, I know she's getting at equality, that she would like to see equality. And if we continue to have these categories, you know, by race, that we're not going to achieve equality. And yes, that is a great ideology, but the reality is that we are not there. And when we see Charlottesville, when we see a president that is berating social groups, you know, and labeling them and criminalizing them, you know, then we are really far from the ideal that we want to achieve.
Nilda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nilda Flores Gonzalez is a professor with a joint appointment in sociology and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She focuses on race and ethnicity, children and youth, identity, Latino sociology, and education. Her new book is Citizens But Not Americans, Race and Belonging Among Latino Millennials. And she joined us this morning from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Baltina with technical direction by executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this conversation is coming to you on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.